Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 17 of NML Crossing, where we're going to be taking a look at the third and final one-shot from the Cataclysm leg of our journey. And it's a book that I'm kind of conflicted on, not because of the content. Well, maybe a little bit because of the content, but we'll get there when we get there. But this is one, it's a weird one because it's like so insignificant, but at the same time, it caused me to break. I have very few rules that I try to impose upon myself as it pertains to comic book collection and just my overall comics enthusiasm, but this book caused me to break one. I broke probably my cardinal rule in comics collecting. Now, those who have ever listened to me prattle on and talk about the rules of comics collecting will probably know exactly what I'm talking about here, but in case you're new or want a refresher, I've always kind of stood by the statement that all of my collecting has to be done in person. You know, everything has to be a hunt, a physical hunt, where I'm physically digging and rifling through bins to procure whatever the hell it is I'm looking for. In my own collecting history, the biggie for me was Lady Cop, the Lady Cop issue of First Issue Special, which, I mean, I could have at any point in time did the one-click buy now, but I wanted to find it in person. So it took me like something like 4 or 5 years of just compulsive digging through every bin I came across until I found the damn thing. But it was a satisfying little hunt, and it's something that I would insist upon. You know, I feel like, I don't know if it's like that there's like a sport to it, you know, like you're actually getting your hands dirty, figuratively and literally. You're getting into the bins here, you're rifling through, you're finding stuff. You might find stuff you never even knew you wanted to find, and I feel like that's a big part of my personal comics fandom. It's just these hunts that are, I don't know, fuel for the, the inner child in me to just play in the bins. But with this issue, I could not find the damn thing anywhere. I think I would feel a lot worse about having to turn to, mycomicshop.com for this if I hadn't done my due diligence. And, I mean, it would have been, you know, dead easy to just pop onto a website and be like, okay, I need these books from No Man's Land. Let's get them all right now. But I live for the hunt. And also, I am a, you know, firm believer in, you know, shopping local. You know, there was a lot of lip service paid to, you know, support your local comic store during the lockdown and the months after. And, I'd see people really, really put it out there that they want people to support their local shops and keep them open and help keep the lights on. And they would tweet that out, and then 10 minutes later, they'd tweet a mail call, you know, where they ordered 5 omnibuses from Amazon or something. So I'm a firm believer in supporting your local shops, and I also believe in actually putting your money where your mouth is in that situation. And that's something I do, and I always have done, and I always will do, to the point where searching for this book, I drove to every place I know of that had a bin in a probably 75-mile radius. So a lot of miles on my car, a lot of miles on my fingers, you know, going through these bins. I wanted to make sure that I literally extinguished any hope of finding this one-shot in the wild before finally resigning myself to the fact that, if I want to keep this show and project going the way I wanted it to, I'm going to have to order the damn thing. Like, if this was an issue from way later in the project, I would not have ordered it. I would have just been obsessively, how do I say that word? I put B's in where B's should go. Obsessively digging through every bin until it came time to, you know, pull the trigger on finally ordering it online. But since this one was relatively early in the project, I had to make a snap decision that sadly felt like a betrayal of myself, which is pathetic and sad, but you know, I am what I am. But I wound up ordering it, and when I did, I still needed two other books for this project, so I threw those on just to kind of justify the shipping, because I think this book was like $2.50, $3, and the shipping would have been like $8, so I figured, well, let's justify that shipping, and I threw a couple more issues. It was an issue of Legends and an issue of Detective for way, way, way later in the project, but rather than eat that full $8 shipping, I figured it would be better to spread it around a little bit. And I wanted to give a big thanks to my buddy Dave for sending me the coupon code to save, I don't remember what percentage it was, but it was like, I guess my comic shop does these regular coupons, which take a certain percentage off of certain titles in certain regions of the alphabet. So I lucked out, and the week that I needed to make the order, it was like all DC books between the letters A and G or something had this percentage off. So I ordered two books with Batman in the title and an issue of Detective, so it all worked out fine. I still don't feel great about it. I do feel like I betrayed the more unflinchingly rigid collector Chris, but yeah, sometimes you gotta bend your own silly self-imposed rules. But anyway, enough of my psychosis. How about we hop into the old asylum and check out some other psychosis. We're talking about Batman Arkham Asylum Tales of Madness number 1 today. It had a May 1998 cover date. The story is called Tales of Madness. Written by Alan Grant with art by Dave Taylor. Colors by Bjarn Hansen and Heroic Age. Letters Bill Oakley. Edits Vincenzo Peterson. Cover price about $3, $2.95. High dollar stuff for the late 90s. Now, we have a trio of chapters here. They're all by the same creative team, but we're going to start with Chapter 1, Democratic Conventions. Now, we open at Arkham, and we're reading from the, I guess, journal or internal monologue of one of the place's newest security guards, a fellow named Greg Rourke. Now, he writes or talks about surviving an encounter with the most dangerous mad folk in the world. And we're invited to follow him along during his third day on the job, as he's trying to put some, you know, money in the bank and finally marry his fiancée. It's a kind of a hard luck story for this guy, and it's, well, it's only going to get worse. Now he, along with more seasoned security guards, a Laney and a Dean, probably not Stephanie Brown's mallmate Dean, but another Dean, they're on their rounds. And they're headed into Killer Croc's cell to change his linens. Just then, well, the clock strikes 7:03 p.m. because alarms start sounding, shutters start shuddering, and before we know it, we're in a post-quake lockdown. Jeremiah Arkham's voice cracks over the PA system to inform the residents and staff that, that very bad thing happened. But not to worry, because Arkham's been fortified with their new Temblor alarm system. Power and phones are out, but the generators ought to be kicking in any moment now. Now, here's the thing. We got our trio of security guards, and, at the moment, they're kind of trapped with Killer Croc. They're armed with a single taser gun, but again, it's Killer Friggin' Croc. Now, he's probably the least likely Arkham resident to be sweating a shock stick. And indeed, they do shock him, and he shrugs it off, and then he kills poor Dean with a single crushing blow. Croc exits his cell and is summoned over to one of his next-door neighbor's rooms, and that room belongs to the Joker. Now, the Joker talks Croc into letting him out, and it doesn't take much in the way of convincing, so I guess it doesn't take long for the party to start hopping. Now, over the next page, Joker and Croc let out a few more of their psychotic peers, and it's actually kind of funny how picky and choosy they seem to be. They release Scarecrow, Riddler, Vox, and Samantha. They don't release Maxi Zeus because he's an annoying dork, Charaxis because he's a pain in the ass, and Mr. Zazz because he's a party pooper. Now, of these characters, I gotta plead ignorance on the ladies, Vox and Samantha. led me to do a little bit of research to discover that, well, there's a reason why I don't know either of these two, because this is the first appearance for both of them. Man, you remember when creators used to put new characters in Bat books? Like, new characters that weren't just variations on Harley Quinn, just differently painted clown girls. Imagine that, right? Anyway, so we got our baddies on the loose in this lockdown, high-security nook of Arkham. And, well, they're looking for some sport. They're looking to skin some security guards. And we're down to just the two of them. And wouldn't you know it, Laney bobbles and drops the taser gun, which alerts the Joker, leading him right on over. And the Joker has a pretty funny line here. He walks up to the guards and asks if the earth moved for them too. Now they yoink the guards out and give them the new lay of the land. Joker cites the Democratic Convention of Majority Rule, stating that since the crazy people now outnumber the sanes 6-2, well, craziness just became the norm of this little social circle. Now the guards are asked to pick their poison as pertains to how they're about to be tortured. Just then, Jeremiah Arkham calls in and checks on the guards. Now the Joker answers the wall phone and he lets Jerry listen as he pumps Laney's brains full of volts with the taser. And, well, it kills him. He's basically fried. So we are down to our last security guard, and it's our focal character, Greg Rourke. Samantha claims to remember his face, stating that he was there in Salem all them years ago when she was burned as a witch. She swipes at him, slashing his face pretty good. At this point, Greg attempts to use some of his Psych 101 toolbox here. It's pretty funny. He's surrounded by psychopaths. He's surrounded by very, very dangerous and violent people. And he decides to attempt to reassert his authority over this crew. He demands they all stand down and return to their cells in an orderly fashion, which, I mean, the baddies find this absolutely adorable, and I agree. The Joker then takes the scenic route to get to our next story beat. He compares the earthquake to the duality of man, order, chaos, good, evil, all that jazz. This inspires an idea. They're going to kill Rourke, yes, but the question, well, he's got two questions, who and how? Well, we're going to have to enter Red Sky territory at this point and spend most of the rest of this issue with a supervillain story competition. The gimmick here is whoever scares Greg the most will earn the right to kill him. Takes us to Chapter 2, Tales of Madness. Now, Rourke is kind of being defiant here. He says he's not going to play along with this silliness. Well, that is until the Joker gives Croc a nod, and Croc wraps his giant scaly hands around Greg's head and proceeds to squeeze. Now, our man, he's hearing all those sounds I would imagine you'd hear as your brain is being, you know, crushed, your cranium's being, you know, I guess crushed. Now, he eventually cries uncle and agrees to play ball with the Psycho Squad. Now our tales of madness are set to begin, starting with Vox. Now Vox, that's V-O-X. I know I can't pronounce words. I don't want you to think I'm saying fox, like the little animal. She basically shares her origin story, which, since this is her first appearance, sort of stands to reason, doesn't it? Now it looks like she was raised by a pair of abusive parents. They were pretty awful to one another, with her mother often physically beating her father. Seeing this, young Vox echoed this behavior with her little brother, eventually, I think, killing him by bludgeoning him with a liquor bottle. Now, the story brings the Joker to a very melodramatic tears, while Greg kind of just sits there in shock, like, oh, that poor child. The Scarecrow insists that, you know, the little brother isn't even the victim of this story, but instead, it's the voices in Vox's head which have now been locked away in Arkham. And yes, Vox does have voices that will... It's really not going to be a huge point of the story, but they exist. Worth mentioning. Now, Vox's voices tell her that she's already won the competition. Unfortunately for her, them voices don't actually get a vote. So, on to our next story, and it's from the Riddler. A very pot-bellied Riddler. It looks very, very strange. If you've seen the cover of this issue, you see he's very bizarre looking, and that's maintained throughout the story. Now, what changes at this point is the art style. Now, the story that Riddler tells is told in... It reminds me a lot of Kyle Baker's work, if you're familiar with that early mid-2000s Plastic Man book. Like, very stylized cartoon. It's pretty cool looking, and it really shows the versatility of Dave Taylor, the artist. Now, the story is, it's the Riddler and his crew attempting to rob the Guru Rishi World Headquarters, which is an odd religious sect of sorts in Gotham. Now, during the job, old Nigma gets to meet the High Holy Guru Rishi himself, only it's actually Batman in a Guru Rishi costume. Okay. Now, there's this riddle playing through these few pages, and it's kind of an existential riddle. It's a one-word question. It's why. I guess we all ask ourselves that question on occasion, right? Now, Bat Guru Rishi solves the riddle with one more word. Because. And well, that's it. Back in reality, such as it is, Scarecrow disqualifies the Riddler since his story sucked. It also wasn't true, and also it sucked. Vox, the violence vixen, sees this tension among the baddies as a sign that there's a fight about to break out, and this excites her a lot. Anyway, let's get to the next story, and that one is Killer Crocs. He shares a very short story where he feeds some dude to an alligator. That's it. Vox says that she doesn't want to hear about people fighting, not even crocodiles or alligators. She actually just wants to see a fight. Off to the side, we can see that she is in the middle of pocketing the guard's giant ring of keys. So what she's going to do with it, we'll probably find out very soon. Crocs assumes that his story won, just like everyone else. Joker tells him to settle his tea kettle for a bit because story time ain't over just yet. Next up, Samantha, or as the DC Wiki calls her, Witch. It, like Vox's story before, is, an origin story. Or whatever she believes her origin story to be. We zip back to the days of witch hunting in Salem, Massachusetts. Worth noting, maybe, but the wife and I actually visited Salem last Halloween. It was a pretty neat trip, but definitely a lot more low-key than we were led to believe from the stories that we'd heard about how, you know, nuts and crazy the town goes during October. It was still a fun little side trip that we were able to add to our visit to Boston. And I was also able to pop in on a comic shop, which, since it was the only one there, I gotta assume was probably the comic shop that Reggie visited when he lived there. Anyway, Samantha is hunted down by the Witchfinder and gets a pentagram branded on her head and also gets burned at the stake. She vows vengeance and all that, and then she's reincarnated and she still holds a grudge. Now, again, she believes that our man Greg was present during the stake burning and, you know, she goes to attack him, only being held back by the Scarecrow and Riddler. Kind of a missed opportunity here, in my opinion. I feel like her little origin story should have included a guy who, I don't know, kind of resembled Greg. I don't know. Oh, well. Just then, we get a party crasher in the form of Charaxis. You see, Vox let him out of his cell in order to incite a fight. And a fight she gets. So we get a couple pages of Killer Croc pummeling the holy hell out of the Bugman. And then the Joker gives Rax a tase for good measure. So, he's KO'd, or at least out of commission. Time for our next tale. And it is the Scarecrow, who tells a story of a family who lives in a house. The house, unfortunately, is also the home to the devil. He lives in the basement, though. Anyway, the family grows to distrust one another to the point where they lock themselves in the house and chain themselves to pieces of furniture and, eventually, to each other. This causes their two puppies, Fifi and Fofo, to fear that they'll never be fed again. And so, these two tiny dogs decide to eat their owners. And that's it. That's the story. We got one left to tell, but looks like it's going to require its own chapter. Chapter 3, The Jigsaw Man. And it's story time for the Joker. Now, he tells the story of firing what appears to be paint into a group of people. Only it ain't paint, it's a acid gel. This causes Batman and Robin to arrive on the scene, and they find themselves blasted with Joker toxin and fall into rapturous laughing fits. Joker then stabs Robin in the heart while Batman yucks it up, and it looks like he's about to stab Batman when the story ends. That's it. From here, we hop back to reality, such as it is, and all eyes are on Greg. The baddies are looking at him to choose the scariest tale of madness he'd been told. And Greg, he can't seem to decide. But our bad guys keep pressing. He finally cracks and he reveals that they all won. All of the stories scared him the same. The scene closes out with the baddies approaching our hero and everything going to black. Our next scene opens after Arkham's backup generators kick on. Jeremiah leads a crew of heavily armed guards into the high security area for a sweep. And they find, well, not much considering. All of the dangerous folks are safely tucked away in their cells. The only baddie out of his cell is the KO'd Charaxis, and so Jerry and the gang assumes that Rax killed those two security guards. They then come across Greg and are kinda taken aback. We don't see what they see, but we will. Our next and final scene occurs 1 week later. Greg's fiancée, a Miss J, is at the asylum hoping to be able to see Greg. Jeremiah tries to dissuade her from paying this visit, as Greg was pretty traumatized and changed during the quake. Miss J insists and is finally led down to the cell they're keeping the poor guy in. We close out with J getting an eyeful of her fiancé and, well, he's chained to the floor and has gone quite insane. His body is carved and scarred up with the names of his captors. He's no longer Greg Rourke. He is now instead the Jigsaw Man. Who, I mean, for a last page reveal, I don't even know if we're going to ever see him again. But that's where we're going to leave it for today. Next episode, we are finally wrapping up Cataclysm in Robin number 53, I think. But for now, let's talk about this little ditty. And it was a weird one, wasn't it? From a Cataclysm standpoint, I feel like we were kind of in that Pink Skies territory. Maybe not full-blown Red Skies, but Pink Skies. Sure, I mean, the quake and the subsequent lockdown wound up facilitating the sharing of our tales of madness, but honestly, it really could have been anything. Could have been a riot, a power outage. It didn't have to be the quake. And, I mean, we really didn't see anybody reacting to the fact that there was a quake. So, I mean, we could have gotten here from many different paths, is what I'm trying to say. But that said, this was a fun little story. And I tell you, I went in expecting very, very little. Which is probably the seasoned comics fan in me having like a hair trigger automatic bias against any book with Arkham in its title. And I guess books with the Joker front and center. I feel like there's just too damned much Arkham, in my opinion, I guess. I mean, when I kicked off this episode, I talked about diving in the bins for this book, and I learned something pretty funny, that several comic shops in my neck of the woods have full-blown Arkham sections in their bins. That's how much Arkham there is out there. Like, you go through the Batman section, and then you get, like, Batman-Arkham, and there's, like, many, many inches of books in the bins. It's pretty funny to see. It was refreshing to see because I was looking for the damn book, but at the same time, I don't know, I feel like there's too much of that. Anyway, after I got this, but before I read it, I did flip through the book. I noticed that there were chapter headings, and I wondered if it was going to be like a true anthology, like different creative teams on each individual story, stuff like that. And I tell you, what I saw during that flip through didn't fill me with excitement or optimism. I was like, uh-oh, I wonder if the quake even happened, you know? Because all you're seeing are these, like, weird and wacky stories in, you know, different art styles. But, you know, I gotta say, I come away from this one rather pleasantly surprised. It actually sort of served as a neat little break from the overall quake story, and also gave us a bit of a reminder that these folks are likely to be getting involved as we work our way through this project. Now, as for the individual tales of madness, Yeah, mostly a mixed bag. Well, actually, mostly kind of bad, in my opinion. I think they were bad on purpose, though. They were silly and largely pointless, sort of kind of non sequitur stories. However, they did serve the real story well. They also kind of came across as the sort of stories that a crazy person might tell, which, like I said, feels like it was kind of the point. Definitely can't hold that against it. And it's also worth reminding myself that this was written by Alan Grant, who kind of took it upon himself to write the more psychological stories during this era, or this decade of Bat books, where he would focus on the villains and kind of try to dig into what makes them tick. So, this weirdo sort of kind of anthology book is pretty good evidence of that. The art throughout this issue was mostly really good, and highlighted the versatility of Dave Taylor. Though, I do feel like some of the character designs were a little bit weird. And I mentioned that pot-bellied Riddler. That one kind of stands out. Though, you know, in fairness, this did come out during late 90s DC. This is pre-DiDio, trying to shoehorn the whole everything old is new again approach into every single book. Back when we'd be like I remember when I jumped to the DC side of the table and I started reading Green Lantern, and you'd see guest spots from Guy Gardner and Jon Stewart, who were retired, and they were like embracing middle age, and they were like satisfied in a mentor like role. Like they weren't in tip-top shape, or at least Guy didn't seem like he was in tip-top shape, and it seemed like their days of heroing were probably behind them. Now, maybe the Riddler's paunch was a sign that he was getting up there in years. Or maybe this was just a weird off-model design. Who can say? Now, the art styles employed here, like I said, were really, really cool. Each tale of madness felt as though it was drawn by a different artist. And it also, I don't know, it felt like thematically, right? Like the art style suited the sort of yarn the Arkham All-Star was spinning at the time. It really, really worked well. Overall, I you could do far, far worse than checking this one out. You're not going to get much added value regarding the Cataclysm story, but like I said, it's a fun time all the same, and that's kind of what it's all about, right? Now, speaking of fun times, how about we hop into the NML bag here for some chatter and discussion? We're going to start with a text I got from my buddy Dave yesterday regarding the current whereabouts and whosabouts of the Huntress. Back when I don't remember which episode it was, but we talked about the Huntress. We've been talking about her a lot lately. And I made the comment that I don't even know if she's around anymore in the, you know, current dawn of DC, whatever we're calling it, landscape. And my buddy Dave wrote and said, yes, the Huntress is around right now in the Justice Society of America book. And it's the version you know, the daughter of Batty and Catty from the Other Earth. And I believe that Justice Society was, I think Geoff Johns launched like that new Golden Age, which I know I'm buying. I just I haven't read any of it. I'm sure they're probably not too far from me right now. But yeah, I've never opened one. Mostly because, I don't know, I don't have any trust in DC in as far as these stories mattering. I feel like DC is so fair weather that like they can reboot at any moment. You know, it took us, 13 years to get a Justice Society again. And I could see them pulling the plug any day. So I have not, it's hard for me to just let myself enjoy things for what they are, I guess. I always have to ruin it for myself. But I guess there you have it. If you want to read contemporary Huntress, you can do that in the new Justice Society of America book. So thanks very much, Dave, for letting us know. Next up, Billy D. wrote in, and he says, I just finished up the last two episodes, and they were enjoyable as usual. The After Comics talk on today's episode really grabbed me. I believe this was episode 15? When you talked about the ending of From Claremont to Claremont, it was very sublime. It takes a lot of courage to say what you did about the end of the show and your own imperfections. We all have them, but that doesn't make it any easier. It was definitely a proud friend moment. This meant a lot to me. I even shared this one with my wife, and I don't generally share feedback with the wife, but this one affected me a bit. I feel like if people are going to dedicate even like a moment of their time to listening to me talk, the very, very least I can do is be completely honest and open and transparent. And, in as far as this pseudo career in podcasting, I've made a lot of mistakes. And they were dumb mistakes. They were not, they weren't like technical mistakes. They weren't informational mistakes. They were just me being bad at this mistakes. Despite the fact that there's thousands of hours of my voice recorded right now, no one's going to be able to convince me that I'm any good at this. When I think about me doing this, it feels like if there were someone who wrote for a TV show that was suddenly thrust onto the TV show. I don't think my talents, even using the word talent is silly to me, but the presentation and the performance aspect and the post-publication aspects of the show, or any show, not my strong suit. I know what I am sort of good at, and that's compiling research and putting it together in a presentable way. When it comes to presenting and to like propagating it, I am almost painfully unequipped or under-equipped for that. It's weird. I have like this, like if you build it, they'll come sort of a philosophy where I think that the amount of work you put into something automatically begets you, I don't know, recognition or an invitation into the discussion about whatever topic you're choosing to talk about and research and dive into. But that's not the case. That's not the case, and that was a very bitter pill for me to swallow. And I don't know. In my time away, I think I hope I've gained a measure of clarity and maturity regarding expectations and just exactly what I want out of this little pseudo creative outlet. I kind of know what I'm okay at, and I know what I'm not okay at. And, I barely even promote this program because I know that that's not my strong suit. And I know that's where my underlying bitterness grew last time. And I don't want that. I want this just to be fun. I want this to just be for the people who want it, and that's one of those things where I used to tell myself that. I'm pretty sure I've told myself that on the air before, and it's something that's very, very easy to say. It's one of those concepts that is simple, but it's not easy. It's not easy to actually play that ball, right? But at the end of the day, we've got to. And, we keep doing whatever we can do to keep this light and fun and keep it from driving you absolutely insane and taking over your life. But thank you so much for that message, Billy. It really did mean a lot to me. And I'm serious. I showed the wife, which I don't ever really do. Next up, our pal Eric wrote in. He says, I'm just answering some topics you mentioned in last week's episodes. He says, I have a collector's problem as well that I struggle with. I start by collecting one character, and then I wind up collecting issues each month for multiple characters. I then realize I have to cut back and just focus on what I'm mainly interested in reading, and I also used to save up my lunch money to buy comic books. And I mean, that's always the way, isn't it? I remember the few times that I've had to step away. I stepped away for fake-ass moral reasons back in the 90s when I got sick of foil covers making books three times the cover price of what they'd usually be. I also took steps back when I was broke. You know, I moved house in 2004, where I had to reprioritize my spending. And then lost my house in 2008, lost my job, lost my house, lost pretty much everything in 2008. And had to stop, you know, comics were gone. You know, I couldn't even buy a comic book a month. I couldn't buy food. I couldn't buy comics for sure. And each time I came back, with this sort of minimalist mindset where it's like, okay, I'm coming back here and okay, I'm just buying X-Men. You know, I'm not even buying all the X books. I'm going to buy X-Men and Uncanny X-Men because those are my books. And before I know it, I'm buying everything again. And then I'm jumping across the table again to DC. And then I'm picking up indie stuff. And then I'm picking up everything. It's just crazy how that happens for so many of us. And then we have to pare things down. And then you have to make those tough decisions. And I mean, they can be really tough decisions. I know a lot of the factors that I put into it is like, how long of an uninterrupted run do I have on this book? Like, it's something that I talk about with friends is Action Comics. The current Action Comics stuff, I've tried it and I do not like it. It's not for me. You know, I just don't think it works. And I'd love to drop it, but I have a full run of Action Comics going back to like the mid-400s. So it's like I feel like if I were to stop now, it would be ending this, you know, 40 plus year run on a title. And that's exactly what it would be doing. So it's like, okay, well, that gets filed and can't quit you. It's always going to be Action Comics. Also, I don't know if this is a universal comic book fan thing, but I find that, you know, the top of my pile is rarefied air. You know, like when you buy a stack of 10 books for any given week, the top of your pile is like that one or two books you really want to read, and the rest of them are kind of the collective bottom of the pile. It doesn't matter what order you read them in, you're not more excited to read one than another. So when you have to start paring down your spending, it's like, where do you even start? Because most of your pile is the bottom of the pile. So, I don't know, it's tough decisions. Back to Eric. He says, anthology books to me are sometimes confusing because you don't know what is in continuity and what is not. When I read X-Men, I also read X-Men Unlimited. I didn't understand it at the time if it was canon or not. In the Batman Chronicles, however, there was a Barbara Gordon origin story in one of the issues. Of course, it was reconnected by Zero Hour, but it was an interesting story. And Eric sounds just as conflicted as the rest of us on anthology books, right? There's a place for them, but at the same time, it's like I don't know. They just don't feel worth it all the time, especially since they are, generally speaking, so overpriced. I mean, nowadays we get anthologies almost every month, and though the, you know, I guess the average price for a new comic is probably around $4.50 right now, so we got a lot of $4 and a lot of $5 are creeping in, so about $4.50 per average comic. These anthologies are usually like 9 or 10, and that's a lot of damn money. That ain't impulse buy. That's like an investment. That's a lot of money for a single book that there's very little quality control on. And you don't know if any of the stories matter or if they're just there to be experienced. I don't know. That's the kind of stuff that I get hung up on. Because, I mean, it's definitely usable format for trying out new talent and maybe exploring stories that wouldn't work as an ongoing. I mean, I get that. We've talked about that. But, I don't know. You know, anthologies were born in the Golden Age, you know, almost 100 years ago, because they were trying to give people bang for their buck, or they were trying to introduce new concepts and characters. And I can't really argue the value of, you know, Golden Age anthologies. They were what they were. That said, if we found out tomorrow there were no more anthologies ever going to be made, I'd be okay with that too. Definitely feels like something that is a yesteryear sort of thing, kind of like annuals. I remember when Jemison Quesada took over at Marvel, and for a few years we didn't get any annuals, and I thought that was really cool, because annuals are, generally speaking, a waste of time. Of course, there are some annuals that were big deals and were important and were, you know, concluding chapters of a really, you know, a seminal story, like, you know, the Judas Contract. That ended in an annual, and, it was like a big special thing. I wasn't there for it. I, you know, read it way after the fact, but it felt important. It felt like a real crescendo to the story. But when Jemison Quesada took over at Marvel, they're like, why are we wasting time with annuals? Let's just put out a 13th issue of the ongoings. And I liked that. I liked that approach much better because, like I said, annuals are kind of nebulous, or they were at that point, and they kind of fall in line with the anthology format as well. And I don't know, I'd rather just get some actual in-continuity canon stuff here. That's my hang-up as a comic fan. I want everything to matter. I want to feel like I'm, you know, with every single book, I'm building onto my lore library, you know. That's probably why I was never really a big fan of, like, Elseworlds and Marvel's What Ifs. Those always felt so, I don't know, weak. Back to Eric. He says, about Nightwing, I think his best stories are in the 90s when he got his own ongoing series. Before he got his own solo series, I did enjoy it when he showed up in the Batman comics. And yeah, those Dixon and McDaniel Nightwing issues, like I was saying when we talked about the last issue of Nightwing, such a sweet spot, such a great mix of superhero and soap opera, and just, it was just really, really good stuff. It really walked the line between, like, comfortable and pushing the envelope, you know? Like I said earlier, DC in the late 90s felt like a company on the move, you know, and I say this mostly in retrospect since I was not a DC reader at the time, but things like legacy characters and new young characters taking over the mantle for established characters, characters retiring, characters getting married, it just felt like, I don't know, the universe was maturing and growing up with us. It was one of the things that separated it from Marvel in my mind back in the day. But when DiDio came in, it got a little marvelous over in DC, for better or for worse. For me personally, I think they took kind of a step backwards in, you know, bringing back Hal and Barry and utilizing like three crises in a 3-year span. It just felt, I don't know, and I'm sure from a business standpoint it worked, but just felt like a step back to me. I really appreciated how in the late 90s things were a little bit different at DC. Back to Eric here. He says, I also want to comment on the Huntress. Huntress is a very entertaining character, and I think Batman Huntress Cry for Blood is a great story showing the differences between Huntress and Batman's ways of solving problems in the city. Now, I know for a fact I own the first issue of that, because it's a not so much a standout cover, but it's one I think you'd recognize if you saw it. Never read it, which is probably no surprise, but I tell you, the interactions we've had with Huntress over the past several episodes and issues are really making me want to check out some 90s Huntress. I might actually drag the Robin 3 miniseries out of the long box at some point and take a look at it. Because, like, up till now, I really had very little interest in this take on the Huntress, or actually any take on the Huntress. So, I don't know, it's pretty neat to get this bit of education on a long-ignored character. But thank you so much for writing in, Eric. I always like hearing from you and look forward to hearing from you more. Last up is a good friend of ours, Chris Yu, left some comments over on the blog. Says, I know I'm a little late to the podcast, but as someone who have read all these issues month by month as they came out, I'm interested to see what I remember and how this story holds up after so long. I'm also interested to hear your opinions on this, quote, new-to-you storyline. Well, Chris, I'm so happy that you're here, and I'm definitely looking forward to comparing notes with you as we work our way through the project. Chris continues, Dick Grayson is my DC character. I'm in a Bronze Age rabbit hole lately, so the Robin Bronze Age Omnibus is one of my prized possessions right now. I no longer collect, sold my collection 14 years ago and haven't looked back, so I love reliving my nostalgia through your collection. And it's kind of funny you mention that. I've talked kind of an inch deep, mile wide about how the last couple of years have treated me personally. And there actually came a time last spring where I came very close to just getting rid of my entire collection. I was just done with everything. It was a a troubling sign, I'll say. It was a troubling sign that I wanted to do that. I just woke up one morning and I'd had it, you know. I think I had a couple of DCBS boxes that I'd never even bothered to open. I wasn't going to the bins. I wasn't going to the shops. I just did not care. I was in a pretty dark place. And I was just like, screw it. You know, there's like 30-something thousand of these things in this room I'm sitting in right now. And it's like, I just didn't want any of them anymore. Like, you know, so I think sometimes when you have a large collection and you think about your necessities, you know, like, oh, if, you know, if I could only save one of these boxes, which would it be? You know, I was at a point last year where it was like, no, take all of them. I don't need a single reminder of this. And I actually talked about it with a couple of friends, and they were troubled by it as well. It was not a good time. Without going into the painful specifics, I'm glad that that's mostly behind me right now, but when you said that, it just reminded me that for a minute there, I didn't think I'd have a collection anymore, or have any interest in a collection. Chris continues, something that popped into my head listening to you talk about buying comics as research for a project. Can you claim those expenses on your taxes as a business expense? Oh, dude, could you imagine? Can you imagine claiming those on taxes? Wow, I'm sure there are probably people out there who do make enough money to claim on taxes. Like, I guess you could probably, there's probably a little bit of research material you could do that with. I think largely it would be like web presence, you know, paying for hosting, paying for domains, stuff like that would be easier to qualify and quantify, I suppose, as a tax write-off. But yeah, I mean, boy, if I could write off what I buy comics wise that'd be pretty interesting. But no, I do not. Last word from Chris here. He says, oh, by the way, I'm still reading the Dawn of DC Titans thanks to you. Not sure for how much longer though, because Beast World is turning me off. And yeah, I stopped reading the Dawn of DC Titans pretty early on. Like I said, it came at a time where I was kind of just not in a good place. And I think I saw that She and Titans show and project as sort of a lifeline at that point, where it's like, okay, this is something I'm passionate about, something I'm interested in, it's something I really want to talk about, it's a franchise that I really want to reacquaint myself with. And then it's like, okay, well, we're going on hiatus for Night Terrors, and then, oh, wait, no, here's a giant crossover that's full of these giant-size anthologies that are gonna just take over the Titans line for a number of months. And then there's the miniseries that are kind of trying to reinvent wheels that don't need reinventing, and those were being haunted by ghosts of ex-lapsed past that I didn't want to revisit. So, yeah, I've got a pile of Titans sitting next to me. I just haven't opened an issue since, I think, issue 2? Because I think after 2, it went into Night Terrors for a couple of months. So, yeah, I've got a lot of catching up to do if I feel like catching up. But, I definitely want to thank Chris for checking out the show. We're going to be hearing a lot from him over the course of the next few episodes, so look forward to that. And of course, if you want to join the conversation, I encourage you to do so. You could find me a whole lot of different ways. It is weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, Chris is on infiniteearths.com, also gothamquake.com, which redirects right to that. 90s X-Men on Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter X. I also uploaded the first 5 episodes of this program to YouTube, so hopefully I'll remember to link to that. If you're listening to this, you've already heard those, so you probably don't need to hear those again, but I have been making sure to export these episodes twice. I do one without the theme music and one with. So theme music goes on the pod feed, without will, you know, be clumped and thrown on YouTube eventually. So if you're the sort to use YouTube as background noise while you do other things, well, now you can have me as your background noise. You can do far better, but I'm there if you want. But I think we've gone on long enough for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for indulging my own tales of madness. And till next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to